From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Tom Clavin is my guest. Tom Clavin is the author or co-author of 16 books. He's written for the New York Times, and he's contributed to magazines like Golf, Men's Journal, Parade, Reader's Digest, and Smithsonian. His latest book is The DiMaggio's, Three Brothers, Their Passion for Baseball, Their Pursuit of the American Dream. Tom Clavin, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
I'm glad to be here talking to you.
Why do you think there are so many more books about baseball than other sports?
Well, I think one obvious answer is many people still consider it the national pastime. You know, certainly in recent years, the argument can be made that as football become more popular. But I think more people still watch more baseball games and talk baseball than any other sport, especially when you consider it's a 162-game schedule. On any given night, there's several games on that somebody could watch. So I think for that reason, baseball continues to be a very interesting sports topic for the general public. I think also, too, because baseball lends itself to writing about it because of its long history. Football, basically, for most people, nobody really knows anything about pro football, let's say, before the 1950s, and same thing for basketball. But, you know, baseball, professional baseball, the first professional team was the Cincinnati Redlegs in 1869. It's been a part of our post-Civil War history. So I think that lends itself to people writing about it and people wanting to read about it.
You think it's a more intellectual or head sport than football?
I tend to think so. I mean, another sport that's very popular for books is golf.
Which you write about a lot.
Yeah, I do. And when you think about golf and about baseball, they are kind of intellectual sports. There's not that there isn't strategy in basketball and there isn't strategy in hockey or in football, but I think both are such deliberate sports in a lot of ways. That there's a lot more thinking that goes on, and the attempt to outthink your opponent, and I think that lends itself to writing, too.
Well, Tom Clavin, your new book about the DiMaggio's, you do a wonderful job of giving us the milieu in which they rose, especially talking about the early Bay Area team, the Seals.
Mm-hmm. San Francisco Seals, and also the entire Pacific Coast League. I mean, one of the revelations to me, I knew there was a Pacific Coast League, but to find out how important it was in the 1910s, the 20s, the 30s, that the salaries were almost comparable to what ball players in the major leagues were getting and the competitions and how fierce it was. And realizing, too, that until the Dodgers and the Giants moved west from New York to take up residents in San Francisco and Los Angeles, the farthest west professional baseball city was St. Louis, the Cardinals. So that whole other part of the country was without Major League Baseball for decades. The closest thing they had, at least on the West Coast, was the Pacific Coast League.
And under the Pacific Coast League, did they broadcast on the radio?
They did. You know, they had broadcasters. They had, they had a fan following. They were getting big crowds. Of course, like many other sports, their toughest time was in the early to mid-1930s because of the Depression, but that's when Joe DiMaggio came along, and he's kind of credited with saving the Pacific Coast League because he was this young, 1933 was his first full season with the San Francisco Seals, and his brother Vincent had gotten him the job, basically, and that's when Joe went on a 61-game hitting streak. I mean, five more games than what he did professionally in 1941. And people couldn't stay away. You know, sometimes they had to decide, am I going to buy a ticket or, you know, get that extra potato for dinner, for the family dinner? And they would go see the baseball game because they had to know, is Joe gonna get another hit? And so they, and not only in San Francisco, but every city that the Seals played in, San Diego and up in Seattle, and they wanted to see if Joe was going to get that hit. So the people kept coming to the ballpark, even with the country in terrible economic situation.
Where did the Seals play?
They had there were several parks in San Francisco that the Seals played in, and it's not, unfortunately, those parks, the last one is not there anymore. The the Pacific Coast League, for the most part, came to an end in 1957-58 when the Giants and Dodgers moved out, because, you know, as you can imagine, now they can, the fans on the West Coast could embrace Major League Baseball, and they didn't, they were kind of disaffected from what was essentially a minor league organization. But they built several ballparks, and they had the money to do so because it was the Pacific Coast League was popular.
Well, one day I was on the train coming back from Pacific Bell Park, as it was then known, and I happened to run into Hank Sauer.
He was a good ball player.
Yeah, he was the National League MVP in 1952.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had a long conversation about baseball, and we talked about Joe DiMaggio, because at that time there was a book that had just come out that was really not very complimentary to...
That was probably Joe DiMaggio, The Hero's Life.
Right.
Yeah.
And Hank Sauer was very unhappy about it. And he said that he knew DiMaggio quite well and that he was just a terrific guy, that he didn't like to talk much, but that he was a very sweet and wonderful guy. So do you think history has been unkind to Joe DiMaggio?
I think that book was unkind to Joe DiMaggio. And I think the author had a certain attitude that when you read the book, and there's so many good things about the book, I don't want to denigrate the book. He did a tremendous amount of research, and there's a lot of fascinating stuff in there. It's worth reading. But I think that the tone of the book is that kind of a wise guy kind of thing, like, okay, it's time to totally debunk Joe DiMaggio, knock him off the pedestal that he's been on. And I think that's too bad. That's kind of unfair to Joe. Was Joe DiMaggio kind of distant? Yes. Did he have social problems? He sure did. There's a story in my book about he had gone up, his brother Dominic had asked him to come to a fundraising dinner and help raise money for this children's charity, and Joe, of course, said yes to his brother, and he's sitting on the dais, and Dick Flavin is the master of ceremonies, a longtime fixture in Boston and the Red Sox. And he says to the crowd, the audience at this luncheon or dinner, whatever it was, I'm going to tell you a story about Joe DiMaggio you've never heard before. And somebody yells out from the audience, is it about Marilyn Monroe? And that's the kind of and Joe just froze, and he really couldn't participate the rest of the evening. So that's the kind of stuff that he had to put up with, questions about his personal life, about Marilyn Monroe, and it was very, very hard for him, especially as he got older, to open up to other people.
We're talking with Tom Clavin, and his newest book is a book about the DiMaggios called The DiMaggios, Three Brothers, Their Passion for Baseball, Their Pursuit of the American Dream. There's a marvelous picture in your book of the last meeting of the DiMaggio brothers.
Isn't that poignant? Yeah.
It's very beautiful. And there's a beautiful picture on the front of this book. I have the paperback. Of them, I guess, taken several years earlier. Tell us about this picture on the cover.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that connection, because it was deliberate on my part to have that photograph of the three brothers at Old Timers Day in 1986 be the last photograph, basically, because you have the cover shot, which is this. I love that shot of the three brothers that was taken in the 1930s and. Their life is their oyster. You know, they love each other. They're at the beginning of their careers, and they're each having a chance to pursue that American dream, and everything's wonderful. And then the last photo in the book is the one of the three brothers at Old Timers Day in Fenway Park in May 1986. The Joe and Dominic, not knowing that their brother Vince was terminally ill at that point, and you see that life took its toll, but yet they're still brothers, and there's still something very special bond between them, and they're feeling it for what turned out to be the last time.
So what was their relationship was pretty complex.
It was complex. It was very simple, really, before they got into baseball, because they were just brothers growing up and trying to help their parents make a living.
A large family.
They were, Giuseppe and Rosalie DiMaggio both immigrated from Sicily and had nine children, five boys and four girls. And, life obviously for many of us is simpler when you're a kid and then gets more complicated when you get to be an adult and when you're, getting into career and everything. And in the case of Vincent and Joe and Dominic, their career turned out to be baseball, and they were playing on different teams, and they had different skill levels. And you had the obvious issue of Joe being a great, great ball player right from the beginning. You know, it wasn't like you look at somebody like a Mickey Mantle. It took him a couple of two, three, even some would even say 4 years before he became a superstar in the Yankees. Joe was a superstar from the beginning. You know, Lou Gehrig was still on the team when Joe joined it in 1936, but right away Joe was the next generation, the next great star, and he had these two brothers who were also hoping to get their place in the sun in the major leagues, but Joe was just great, and everybody called him great. It wasn't like there were a lot of people who were saying, well, he's not that good, really. You know, in New York, which was at the time the media capital of America, he was proclaimed as the second coming, and he actually lived up to it. One of the few times an athlete lives up to the hype.
Now, how did Gehrig react to DiMaggio coming to the team?
Well, Gehrig was pretty generous in that, you know, the year before Joe joined the team, the Yankees had not even come close to winning a pennant, and they had gone a couple of years actually without being in the World Series, and Babe Ruth was gone by this point. Gehrig was aging. And, you know, here's this Italian-American kid from the West Coast who's showing up, getting all this hype. And Gehrig could have reacted in a very negative way, a resentful way, and he didn't. Now, the irony years later is Joe resented the appearance of Mickey Mantle when it was his turn to pass the baton. But Gehrig was fine because Gehrig wanted to win. And with Joe on the team and the way he revitalized the Yankees, it gave them a chance to win. And Gehrig was delighted that, you know, Joe joined the team in 36. They won the World Series. They won the World Series in 37. They won the World Series in 38. And Gehrig was having this renaissance himself at the latter stage of his career. He probably would have played at some reasonably good level for another 2 or 3 years before retiring, except, of course, in 39, it was discovered he had ALS.
Right. You know, nowadays, if a player as a recent Yankee has been suspended for an entire year. When a player loses a substantial part of their career due to injury or whatever, you know, that's a major blow.
Yeah.
And yet DiMaggio lost several years to World War II.
Yeah, he did. I mean, Joe and his brother Dominic both spent 3 years in the service. Now, their circumstances were different because Joe did not want to go into the military. He resisted going in. Dominic, on the other hand, was eager to enlist, and he actually kept getting kept rejected by the Army and then the Navy because his eyesight was so bad.
Hmm.
And he finally got somebody to pull strings for him that got him into the Navy, where he spent 1943, 44, and 45. Joe was not eager to go into the service. I mean, at the time, he was making $70,000. In salary, and the Yankees were winning the World Series almost every year, and he was married with a young Joe Jr., a young child, but it got to be very uncomfortable that here you had this superstar athlete who could obviously do things that most other people couldn't do. Well, why wasn't he in a different uniform, like an Army uniform? So he started getting heckled, and Joe had never been heckled before, had never been people booing him. And even his wife said to him, "Joe, you know this is embarrassing. You got to join the Army." And so, as a result, yes, Joe lost three of his prime years being in the service. Lost a lot of money. Obviously, he traded in $70,000 a year for $250 a month. And when he actually came out of the service in 1945, he was broke. His wife divorced him and took what he had left, and he. He had very little left, and he couldn't wait to sign his contract and get back into a Yankee uniform.
It's hard to speculate, but how might his records have been different if he had not lost those years?
You know, that's an interesting question because, as it turned out, his service in the military, yes, cost him maybe at least 500 hits that would have been on his record, cost him 75 to 80 homers that would have been on his record. But it didn't cost him the ultimate goal for most baseball players, is being elected to the Hall of Fame. You know, that was a no-brainer and he had no trouble getting into the Hall of Fame. His brother Dominic was a different story though, because Dominic, who lost when Dominic was in the service, he was I think 24, 25, 26, 27. I mean, right in those great years when he was leading off of the Boston Red Sox teams that had, you know, Ted Williams and Vern Stevens and Bobby Doerr and Johnny Pesky. Dominic finished his career with a .298 batting average, and he had not lost those years. I think a very good argument could have been made that Dominic belongs in the Hall of Fame. Some people think that anyway. He was just a really good ball player, 7-time All-Star, probably a better center fielder than his brother Joe. And going into the service, which Dominic was eager to do, may have cost him the Hall of Fame. It didn't make a difference for the Hall of Fame for Joe.
You know, you paint this beautiful picture, speaking of that photograph that we were talking about earlier of the three brothers at their last meeting. You paint a great picture of that day in which you talk about how Joe insisted on being called the greatest living ball player. But the audience was really excited about Dominic.
Yes. Yeah, well, Dominic a lot of people might say, gee, I never knew there was a Dominic DiMaggio. Or I heard that Joe had a brother who played baseball, but I just figured he was just, you know, riding on Joe's coattails. He came up for a cup of coffee, and, that was his major league career. But Dominic was an excellent ball player. And, played all those years in the Boston Red Sox and was on the team that won the American League pennant in 46, which was the last time, you know, they went to the World Series until I think they played the Reds in the 70s. Strzemski's team in 67 played the Cardinals. But in Boston, Dominic is a legend. I mean, Dominic is a revered figure. And Dominic and his wife, Emily, were in his post-baseball career, they'd spent decades raising millions of dollars for charities in the Boston area, especially ones related to children's pediatric services. So, you know, I learned very quickly, you know, when I visited Boston several times to give talks about this book, to never condescend and say most people don't know but Dominic was a very good player. They know that Dominic was a very good player.
And we're talking with Tom Clavin, and his latest book is The DiMaggios. You mentioned that the DiMaggios were Italian, and their parents had immigrated here. How much was that an issue? Was it an issue to have Italian players in the Major League?
Joe found it was not unusual by the 1930s. He had a great ball player who's in the Pacific Coast League, went on to the Major Leagues, named Ernie Lombardi. And you also had, in the case of the Yankees specifically, you had Frank Grissetti and Tony Lazzieri. And Lazzieri was an RBI machine for the Yankees, along with Gehrig and Ruth in the late 1920s and 1930s. So as far as the New York fans were concerned, having an Italian-American join the team was not a big deal at all. In fact, they welcomed it because, especially with Lazzieri, they had seen such good results. So that was not really an issue for Joe. He was, and of course he was coming to a city which had a pretty strong Italian American constituency. So he was welcomed with open arms.
Joe DiMaggio had kind of a childlike quality about him. Like for instance, when he misses the home run, he kicks the dirt.
Yeah, he did. You know, Joe, I mean, if somebody was more of a psychologist than I am, you could start making a case for something like arrested development with him. You know, he grew up, he was the second youngest of 9 children. His 4 older sisters doted on him. He was pampered as a kid growing up and immediately found success as a baseball player and was considered a star and people were always, what can I do for you, Joe? Let me do anything for you, Joe. And so Joe, in some ways, was a big kid. And there's so much that he never quite figured out about dealing with other people. And that's kind of sad, actually, because in a lot of ways, Joe's life was, especially after baseball, was quite unhappy.
But he sold a lot of Mr. Coffee machines.
He made money, especially as he got older and what had previously been a pretty much a non-existent memorabilia market emerged. And you know, he was you know, signing things for increasing amounts of money. And he's the Bowery Savings Bank, Mr. Coffee. He was on boards of directors and so making money that way. So, but, you know, the business side was fine, and he made money, but personal life was pretty unhappy. It was obvious with Marilyn Monroe dying. And, you know, one of his nephews said to me about Joe, you know, responding to the topic of that he was very aloof or very distant and seemed like he didn't want to interact with other people. And he said, you know, you have to remember with my Uncle Joe, he, when Marilyn died in 1962, Joe lived for another 37 years after that. He never got married again. He never really had a serious relationship. He lived the rest of his life as a widower.
But he wasn't married to Marilyn when she died.
They were about to get remarried.
Huh.
The plan was that it was a Saturday in August, and Joe met his brothers had asked him, could you come with us to a Seals old timers game in San Francisco? So Joe and Vincent and Dominic got together, and they were up in San Francisco together. They went out that night with Lefty O'Dool. He didn't tell any of them that the next day he was going down to Los Angeles collecting Marilyn. They were flying to New York to get married. And it was that morning when he woke up in his hotel room with the phone ringing that he was informed that Marilyn had died during the night. So in his mind, you know, he had lost his wife, and he never recovered.
Well, you know, there's always been speculation about Marilyn's death. What was his opinion of Marilyn's death? Does anybody know?
Well, he believed that, I mean, I think he believed, I don't think he believed in any kind of conspiracy. Maybe he did as the years went on, but he was willing to believe that it was either an accidental overdose or, you know, possibly suicide. I think that was too tough for him to buy, but he did believe that you know, the Kennedys, for example, had driven her to it, that she would be alive if these other people, like the Kennedys, like some of the, like Sinatra and some of these Hollywood types, had not taken advantage of her. He saw them as having been abusive to her and taking advantage of her. And when he was the one who was in charge of the funeral when Marilyn died, he organized everything, and they were all forbidden from attending. You know, they could not get in, and he made sure that that funeral was Kennedy free and Hollywood free.
Hmm. Well, you know, that kind of tabloid marriage is kind of common now, but that was really one of the first. One, I guess maybe Ava Gardner and Frank Sinatra, but that was really a huge tabloid deal.
It was. You didn't really have the combination of sports and Hollywood marriages. I mean, there had been a kind of a junior version of it a few years earlier when Leo DeRocher was married to the actress Lorraine Day. But, you know, neither one of them were of the stature of Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe. And you know, they were the joining of Hollywood and baseball. There's a story I love that's in the book, in the DiMaggio's, where and Joe, of course, had spent his entire career being idolized. And, you know, he and Marilyn got married in January of 54, and they go to Japan because Lefty O'Dool had organized a tour of baseball players there, and Joe and Lefty were great friends, and Joe couldn't say no. So their honeymoon basically was in Japan. And they get off the plane, and they go to the hotel, and the Japanese people are cheering Marilyn, this beautiful, blonde, emerging American superstar actress. And they get to the hotel, and she's kind of out of breath, and she says, "Oh, Joe, you never heard such cheering." You know, and there's a pause, and he sort of ruefully says, "Oh, yes, I have." You know, he was the Marilyn Monroe, in a sense, of baseball, and that even the rival ballparks, even in Boston, you know, the bitterest rivals, you know, there were times when they stood up and cheered Joe DiMaggio because he would just play his heart out, and he would leave it all on the field.
How did he meet Marilyn Monroe in the first place?
You know, isn't that funny you should ask on this particular day, because this particular week, because Joe and Marilyn were introduced to each other they went out to dinner with another couple. It was sort of like a setup. And then they enjoyed seeing each other, and they made plans the following week to see each other for dinner, just the two of them, and they're having dinner. and over at some place in Los Angeles, and over comes Mickey Rooney.
Oh.
And Mickey Rooney, of course, knew Marilyn, and I thought Joe was wonderful and terrific. And Mickey starts telling stories and singing and doing shtick for like a half hour. And I don't know, I guess he's trying to impress Joe or something like that. And finally, Joe just says, "You know, get the hell out of here, will you? I'm with Marilyn Monroe. Why do I want to talk to you?" And he actually chased Mickey Rooney away so he could have Marilyn to himself.
What a lovely story to tell about poor Mickey Rooney today.
Poor Mickey, yeah. R.I.P.
Well, this book, and it's a marvelous book, it's called Thanks. The DiMaggio's Three Brothers, Their Passion for Baseball, Their Pursuit of the American Dream, and the author, Tom Clavin. Thanks so much for spending some time talking about it here on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, that closes the book on this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Tom Clavin. His latest book, The DiMaggio's, Three Brothers, Their Passion for Baseball, Their Pursuit of the American Dream. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.